Imagine spending your day walking among the flowers or living in a hexagonal-shaped home, creating golden coins and ambrosia of pollen and honey. Sweet honey. It would seem to be a being of high consciousness, but coming up against one of these beings, it seems we worry only about being stung. Today's guest, Simon Buxton, is a beekeeper and director of The Sacred Trust, a United Kingdom-based educational organization dedicated to the practice of shamanism. Simon's book, The Shamanic Way of the Bee, Ancient Wisdom and Healing Practices of the Bee Masters, details his experiences of initiation into and life on the path of pollen. Stay tuned. I'm Robin Clare, and this is Tributaries. Simon, thank you for joining us today.
It's a pleasure to be here, Robin.
So, am I the only one who's never heard of the path of pollen? I mean, without meaning any disrespect, it sounds somewhat like the things I dreamed up for my show when it fell on April Fool's Day.
Well, yes. It's true that it is undoubtedly the most enigmatic and, let's say, even private lineage of shamanism in the world. The reality is that the way of the bee is actually near universal. In other words, pretty much wherever the bee, the honeybee, can be found, you'll find there are practitioners of this way of working. I mean, not merely as a kind of metaphor, but also as a repository for an astonishingly rich shamanic knowledge. But the bottom line is that it hasn't been until very recently that any people who work within this lineage have felt a need or a desire to put pen to paper. Historically, the beauty about the way of the bee is that it has been truly invisible. And as a result of its invisibility in the world, that is the very thing that has allowed it to survive. If we reflect on the history of the persecution of shamanic culture and pagan culture right across the world, primarily through missionization and the introduction of modern technologies into the remaining proto-historical cultures, what we see is that it was those very things that actually diminished and fragmented shamanic traditions. But the way of the bee was truly invisible. These were simply beekeepers. And beekeepers have always been popular figures within communities because they've been suppliers of sweet elixirs. So it was a beautiful way for them to remain invisible or near invisible at times when other shamanic cultures and pagan cultures were being persecuted and attacked. And particularly in Europe, nearly all the shamanic traditions were destroyed, with one or two exceptions. So it's true, it is obscure, but the other truth is that it is, in fact, near universal, and near universal, but beautifully hidden, and that has allowed it to survive up until the present day.
Well, that brings a couple of questions to mind. One thing that is becoming more and more obvious is that these shamanic traditions are finding it's time to make themselves known on the planet because of everything that's going on. And there are groups of elders from many traditions that are holding councils together.
Correct.
Now and making a point to really come together.
Yes.
I found it very curious that with your involvement in the Path of Pollen, that you also became involved with Michael Harner's shamanism. And it seems, through my experience, Michael did bring shamanism to the masses, so to speak. He held numerous classes and that sort of thing. And especially reading how your path is continued with one master, one teacher. That was part of my problem with what Michael Harner was doing with shamanism.
Well, that's a really interesting point. And, you know, Michael Harner has been one of my teachers as well. And in the end, he turned around and requested that I teach for the foundation in Britain. I have to say it came as a complete surprise, and I was somewhat of a kind of reluctant teacher initially. But Michael's gift, I think, to the world is that he recognized the universality of shamanic practices. I mean, after all, if we the very word shamanic was originally a specific term relating to a particular people in Siberia and China, but when anthropologists began to see that the practices they saw practiced in that part of the world were also being practiced elsewhere, they borrowed the term shaman, and it became an academic term, if you like, an anthropological term. And what Michael has done is recognize that shamanism, in fact, is a group of methods and practices, and it doesn't need to be culture-centric. Now, that's very important because most people in the world today are not, let's say, indigenous peoples. So by teaching the core methods that you find whenever you choose to inspect an indigenous culture and strip away the cultural glosses, what you find is this core body of methods. And by being able to teach this core body of methods, it means that we don't have to appropriate somebody else's culture. And so I think it's a very liberating thing that he has done. And in terms of the relationship between my relationship with Michael Harner and the Way of the Bee, when I first met Michael, I was delighted to see that the active principles that he was teaching are the very ones that are indeed found within the path of pollen. And we can boil that right down to first principles, which is that the shaman is somebody who moves from this reality into a parallel universe. And I mean, that would be a kind of accepted modern definition of what a shaman does. They move from this reality into a separate reality where they access information, they access wisdom, and they then return back to their community. And that, of course, is the principle that also drives the Way of the Bee, learning how to move into a separate consciousness, let's call it a mythical landscape, by stimulating the mythical imagination. I mean, after all, the other choice is that we stay in the place of rationality. And, you know, if we look at our modern world, we swim like fish in a sea of rationality. And so what we actually really need to do is we need to move from the rational mind into the mythical mind. And by awakening the mythical mind, which is what Bridge, my own teacher in the path of pollen, did, that allows us to explore the mythical landscapes. And it's in those mythical landscapes where we do our work and receive our healing, and also meet our destiny.
Well, I've always felt that rationalization was man's greatest tool, but now I see it almost as, you know, some of our other great tools that can either be used for good or for devastation.
Well, that's it. I mean, it's like a hammer, isn't it?
Yes.
You can use it to build a house or to bang somebody on the head. I mean, these things are neutral. Absolutely.
Now, within this ancient tradition of the Bee Masters, I've heard it said that you work outside and beyond the laws of science. And of course, this relates to the shaman moving into a parallel universe. But maybe you could talk about this a little bit more and how it relates directly to this tradition.
Yeah, I mean, when terms such as outside the laws of science, I need to make it clear what we're talking about is all outside the known laws.
Newtonian, not quantum.
Exactly. So what we're actually seeing is that slowly the scientific community are slowly catching up with what I call the first scientists. The first scientists are our ancestors. It's as simple as that. They were the one who determined how to, for example, work with plants in a medicinal fashion. They were the ones who arrived at the extraordinary body of information from within the way of the bee. In other words, how to use a bee sting as a means of bringing about health and healing and also transcendental states. They were the ones who worked out how to play a percussional instrument at a particular tempo that would move your state of consciousness. So the shamans were the first scientists. Now, sadly, we live in a world where much of science is kind of truncated, primarily because in the age of enlightenment, as it were, so-called, science separated away from the, in Europe, at least from the church, because they were scared of being persecuted by the church as being, potentially as being witches. And in those days, witches were persecuted and killed and so on. So the scientific community pretty much turned around to the church and said, hey, we're just not interested in anything other than the material thing. We're not witches, don't burn us. And at that point, science kind of betrayed us, because at that point, they made a declaration that spirits and spirit did not exist. Now, the truth is that science has a responsibility for disproving theories. It's actually called falsification. And the one area that was so vital to, as it were, disprove was the existence of spirit or spirits. But they chose not to. They chose not to for historically understandable reasons, because they were very nervous of being persecuted. But that left us with a truncated science. So where that left the shamans was that, well, they had already done the science every day, or more often every night, for thousands and thousands of years, at least 40,000 years. They have been communing with spirit and spirits. And when I say communing, I'm talking about encountering this parallel world in a real empirical way. I mean, the common terms are ordinary and non-ordinary reality. So you have ordinary reality, which is this reality, and then you have non-ordinary reality. But if you'll note, both terms use the word reality, which means they can be empirically encountered. So from a shamanic point of view, this other world, this parallel universe, is as real, and for some shamanic cultures, more real than this world. In the tradition that I trained within, the worlds are seen as being both as equally real. And part of the training is to keep on moving from this world into the other world. And slowly, the reality of the other world becomes as real and as important, and the relationships therein as vital as those that you hold, that one holds within this world.
Certainly, the veil does become and can become very thin. And I would like to ask you, Simon, to talk about the bee stings, because we're talking about moving back and forth, and there's a very little known tradition you're about to share with us about bee stings. We've spoken actually on Tributaries years ago about using bee sting therapy for arthritis and arthritis cures. And it's recently come to my attention that there is also something widespread about beekeepers not ever getting cancer.
Yes, that's a most interesting fact.
And frankly, what is that about? Yes.
If there was anything that pushed people towards the possibility of becoming beekeepers, I would say look at the statistics. If anybody could be motivated to go and contact local cancer hospitals and hospices and so on, where they carry statistics, and you look at the list of areas of employment. In other words, which are the professions that have the most common incidences of cancer, and which are those professions that have the least common instances of cancer? And guess what? In every body of statistic that I've looked at, the profession with the least instance of cancer are the beekeepers. And the reasons are very straightforward. It's what the beekeeper encounters in their craft. And here we're talking about the gifts of the hive. And the gifts of the hive, the four most well-known gifts are, of course, honey, which we all know about, and pollen, which we all know about, even if we just know about it from biology class, royal jelly, which most of your listeners will have heard about or maybe even take as a nutritional supplement, and also last but by no means least, that is the venom of the bee sting. And the most recent research would indicate that it's the impact of having the venom going into the system, the human system, that may be the primary reason why beekeepers do not seem to get cancer, or very, very, very rarely. Now, it's interesting because within the tradition that I trained, which formally, by the way, is called the Path of Pollen, the formal initiation into the tradition, because it is an initiatory tradition, it's actually done by the use of bee venom. So the bee venom from the bee sting is considered actually to be one of the great secrets of the tradition. It's actually called sacred fire. And bee shamans over hundreds, thousands of years have mapped out ways of working with the bee sting, much in the way that the needles are used by the modern acupuncturist. And in fact, curiously and fascinating, if you travel to China, you'll find that still to this day, you will find some of the older acupuncturists still to this day dip their needles into bee venom before inserting them into their clients' bodies. So here there's some curious resonance, some echo of the past when the bee was used as the needle. So within the Path of Pollen, it is clearly stated, let's say suggested, because this would be very difficult to prove in terms of documentation, that the original acupuncturists in the world were actually the bee shamans, and they used the bee sting of the bee in exactly the way that the needle is used by the modern acupuncturist.
So the meridians do overlap as far as the system goes?
Well, the meridian systems overlap. There are some differences, but I think, in fact, the most important difference, really, between the, let's call it the Chinese system of acupuncture and the system that has evolved through the Path of Pollen is that, unlike acupuncture, where one is largely working with predefined meridians, the process is slightly different within the bee tradition because one is operating in concert with the bee. In other words, one is within an altered state of consciousness, and the spirit of the hive itself is directing the placement of the bee stings. So yes, there are the meridian systems, but beyond that, it is directed by the wisdom of the hive. Now, the second thing that really needs to be stated, because this also distinguishes it from the Chinese system, is that the sting is not only used as a therapeutic tool. In other words, it's not just used for people who are unwell. It's also used as a tool for creating altered states. So much of my training involved learning how to use bee stings, not only for therapeutic use and healing, because, of course, healing is the cornerstone, the central to the role of the shaman the world over, but also to produce particular altered state experiences. And the primary initiation into the tradition actually involves being stung on the body, which actually creates a certain threshold experience. Now, so what happens is one is stung on points of the body. The master shaman, in communion with the hive, induces an experience in the apprentice, in the person stepping onto the path, which brings about a move, and it's a move from this world into the world of the hive. Essentially, what happens is that one is reborn into the hive. And that rebirth initiates a symbiotic relationship with the hive itself, and if successful, is never broken. So in other words, a marriage is made between the human being and the being who is considered to be our most ancient ally, in other words, the honeybee.
That's very true, isn't it? Along with all of the ancient drawings and depictions of animals, there is certainly the serpent that most people are aware of, but the bee has been in there also.
Well, it's interesting, isn't it? There are a couple of things there. I mean, first of all, that bee shamans know that the honeybee is humanity's most ancient ally. And it's kind of a bold assertion, but it's actually rarely disputed, because the bottom line is they've been on our Earth since the, some 55 million years. I mean, that goes back to Cenozoic period, I think it is, which is around 55 million years. Now, if you want to jump a whole lot forward into, let's say, a period of old Europe, in other words, that's about 7,000 to 3,500 BC, what we find within archaeological digs is that next to serpents, the bees are the creatures that are most often depicted, which is fascinating. And, of course, there are certain things that both the bee and the serpent have in common. Both of them live in small, dark places, and both, of course, carry venom, and both come out of a little hole at certain times of the year. But whereas serpents were often depicted as either symbols of good or evil, bees were almost always regarded as beneficent. The other thing is that there is a curious relationship between the bee and the serpent on a mythical level. Within the bee tradition, the marriage that occurs symbolically between the bee and the serpent creates the dragon. And the dragon is a symbol for the life force that runs through the earth, let's say the meridians of the earth. And you find this in both Eastern and Western cultures, the idea of areas where dragons live. These are areas which are pulsating often with life force. And this is where we get concepts such as the dreaming lines and the ley lines and so on and so forth.
Yes. Now, in using the bee stings, is there something else that goes along with that? I know you termed something called tanging.
Yes.
In your book, and you just spoke a little bit about the tapping and the pulsing, which is something that is used in all the shamanic traditions throughout the world. How does this fit in with the bee tradition?
Well, yeah, that's really fascinating. I mean, it's particularly fascinating, I think, for Europeans, because one of the things that I think many people who work within shamanic traditions in Europe, other than in, say, Siberia or Lapland, is that they say quite accurately that there's no evidence of us having had drums over here. And it's such a universal tool these days for people practicing shamanism. But where are our drums? Where are the British drums, the Irish drums? Those people who are listening to know about the Irish baran, actually, that's a very, very young instrument. It's not an ancient instrument. So to date, there's no archaeological evidence that drums have ever been used by our British ancestors for shamanic work, even within archaeological digs where you'd expect to find them. But within the path of pollen, that's where we find the British and European drum. And it's known as a tanging quoit. And a tanging quoit is a drum made of metal. The bee shaman has used the tanging quoit for, well, you know, it's always a difficult question for how long. Let's say if you go back far enough and when history slips into being myth, let's say. The idea of tanging is actually quite well known within beekeeping itself. If you were to talk to a modern day beekeeper and you would say, what is tanging? They will say, tanging is just some superstitious nonsense where you pick up a saucepan and you bang it and the bees will land on a particular branch if they've swarmed. And it's a classic example of something that has, as it were, leaked out of the path of pollen and is actually based on a real activity based on real principle, that tanging was never done for the sake of the bees. Tanging was done for the benefit of the bee shaman, So the bee shaman would pick up this tool, this metal drum, and would begin to beat it. And they would beat it at a particular tempo, which is typically 4 to 7 beats a second. And that would then put them into an altered state of consciousness. You know, I spoke earlier about how the bee shamans were the first scientists. They understood that if you beat a drum at a particular rhythm, it affected your state of consciousness. Well, the bee shamans, like shamans of the rest of the world, also arrived at that knowing. So the tanging puts the bee shaman into a state of consciousness that allows him or her to commune with the hive. So that tool is also used very commonly and was, of course, used within the initiation process.
Now, a signature of the bee's intelligence certainly is the hexagonal hive.
Yeah.
And that just has its place all over nature and certainly in architecture it's been picked up on.
Yeah. Very right. I mean, the hexagon is enormously significant for a variety of reasons, and therefore the number 6 is considered to be most potent number. Technically, within the bee tradition, it's actually called the hexagramma mysticum, which simply means the mystical hexagon, and I mean, if we consider the geometrical exactitude required to make a shape that where no empty space exists between one shape and another, there is none other in the known universe that is as accurate as the hexagon, where all space is utilized in full, where literally no gaps can arise. And I mean, that says something about the way that the path of pollen functions in terms of its community. But the hexagon is a symbol that represents kind of perfect equilibrium, if you like. It's got extraordinary physical efficiency, and it actually curiously mirrors what will be common to many people listening to this, which is the makeup of a quartz crystal. I mean, across the world, you know, 6-sided quartz crystals that terminate at a single point have been used within many shamanic traditions. And actually, they are a mirror of the bee cell. And the forces within the earth create these hexagonal crystals. And curiously, these crystals are actually contained within every human being. In fact, the human being is actually full of quartz, but it's in a fluid form. So our life is actually dependent on the fact that the body continuously wants to form 6-sided crystals from this fluid that is flowing around the body. So we as human beings have this curious communion with the hexagon within our organism. So we have a kind of natural resonance with the hexagon of the bee. And this is one of the reasons why there is considered to be a relationship by bee shamans between the bee and the human being. The fact that we both respond on a cellular level to the hexagon. It's within us, and it drives and creates the flight of the bee.
Now, in saying that, wouldn't other animals as well? I don't know. I'm just curious.
Well, I'm not a biologist, so
okay.
So I don't. I simply don't know that.
Okay.
You'd need to ask. You'd need to ask a biologist.
Okay, I'll do that at some point. Look out, biologist.
Yeah, right. Robin's coming.
So I've got some great curiosities about what you term as the golden coins. Now, this is speaking about the pollen itself. Is that true?
Yes.
And you mentioned the royal jelly, but the pollen it's an amazing superfood. And to what do you attribute this?
Well, it's curious because I, within my initiation, it involved a period of nearly a month immediately thereafter when actually I lived on pollen and water alone, occasionally with a small amount of honey. And the way that my teacher taught me was to sample pollen from a completely different point of view to begin to try and gain an insight into its gifts. I mean, on one level, you know, nutritionally, it's all pretty common stuff in terms of really what pollen brings. You know, it's very rich in amino acids and proteins, and it helps to suppress appetite, and it's used for treating prostate problems, and it's a great energizer of the body, and it can boost the immune system, and so on and so forth. These things are fairly well known, and I have to say that I'm not a nutritionalist, so those particular areas aren't as interesting to me as the aspects of what the bee tradition has to say about pollen and what it brings. Now, from that point of view, so let's go beyond the nutritional values, which are very commonly found and well known these days. From a shamanic point of view, the flower itself, all flowers, are considered to be the lover of the bee, and so she goes as a bride, if you like. I mean, I should just say that bees, the worker bees, are all female. So the bees who collect the pollen are female. And the bee kind of makes love to the flower. What the bee profits from most is that it derives its sustenance from the very parts of the plant that are pervaded by the plant's sexual energy. So the bee goes into the flower and sucks and collects the nourishment, and that's the pollen and the nectar, from the very parts of the plant that are steeped in sexual power. In other words, the flower's reproductive organs. So the bee then brings this sexual power from what we would call the visible face of spirit. That's another term for nature. It's a poetic way of saying nature. From the visible face of spirit to the hive. And this power, this sexual power that is a gift from the plant, is actually known as vitamin P. And vitamin, of course, listeners will know, vitamin is from Latin, from the word vita, which means life. And P, in this instance, stands for pan. So it's known as vitamin pan. Now, when I was first told this, I was kind of taken aback, because I thought, well, what does Pan, who is the horned stag god of Europe, what could his connection be to pollen and the bees and sexual power and so on? And I later was informed and was that actually Pan is considered to be the guardian of the bees, and this is a very ancient tradition within Europe. So there is this link between Pan, the guardianship of the bees, and sexual power. And it goes on from there as well, that Pan is himself considered to be a carrier of enormous power of sexuality and priapic potency. And his representative on Earth is the stag. So there's a relationship that is established by the bee shamans, not only with the bee, but also with the stag, through which he communes with the horned god Pan. And all of this revolves around the power of pollen, which is to do with the gift of sexual intoxication, which is one of the doorways, not the exclusive doorway, but is one of the doorways that is used to commune with the other world, with the parallel universe, with the separate reality.
Now, another topic that came up very interestingly is the whole way that the hive and the bees work together. I believe that men and women today have certainly always had traditional roles, and it is today that it almost seems like there is an energy to erase or merge male and female roles. And I'm wondering, how you see this. I mean, the bees certainly have their system intact and have for so long. And in a way, I think this could be a good learning place for us.
Yeah, well, I have to agree with you. I think that the path of pollen has got something really constructive to say about this. And it's mirrored right from the very beginning of when one steps into this work onwards, in as much as the bee master, who is the name of the male shaman teacher, he teaches one single male apprentice at a time. But he also has an opposite, and she is known as the bee mistress. And actually, she teaches six women at a time. And although the principles that are communicated to the men and the women are the same, there are certain teachings that are given only by the bee mistress to her own female students. And these women within the bee tradition are known as melissae, melissae. And melissae is a term that's from ancient Greece, and it was adopted by these women. And if you look at your history, you'll discover that in ancient Greece, at the temple of Demeter and Aphrodite, who was also known as Melissa, by the way, the priestesses were called the Melissae, which simply translates as bees. Now, when I first started on this work, I was enormously intrigued by who these women were, because for a start, they were never seen ever without their veils. And their veils were ostensibly there to protect their eyes and their faces from the bees, but they also had a secondary function, which was to create a certain aura of mystery around them. So I would bombard my teacher with questions about these intriguing women, but he refused to shed much light on the matter, and it took me months to discover the most basic information about these enigmatic women. And of course, now I realize that this was all planned in advance. Finally, I turned around to him and I said, well, what on earth is the purpose of these women? Do they actually have one? I'd pretty much given up altogether.
Spoken and like a true chauvinist.
I remember very, very clearly what he said. And he said simply that the knowledge of destiny and the ability to inspire are the two central powers of these women. And he went on to say that the knowledge of destiny is much more than folk magic. It's actually the innate knowledge of type, and it includes the ability to kind of educate and guide a type of person according to the sort of power that that type is meant to have. Well, that was pretty enigmatic to me. You know, I thought, well, what on earth is a type? And I assumed it was a sort of a form of personality or human behavior which might differ from person to person, and that somehow the Melissae could tune in to this in order to offer guidance and an instruction of some kind that was most suited to that individual person. Well, my teacher, the bee master, went on to say that the Melissae were women who lived in a country that was east of the sun and west of the moon, to which there was no known map. And he said that we, men, we are guests. We're just guests of the bee tradition. And that the Melissae are actually our hosts. The reason being, because bee society represents the very zenith of the feminine potency of nature. So in other words, we men are just the drones, and we'd better bloody remember that. Mm. Now, within the path of pollen, the teachings of masculinity and femininity are vitally important. And the bottom line is that the basics of masculinity and femininity haven't changed much for a million years or more. You know, the female consistently does more of the reproductive work, and the male is, I'm afraid, men listening out there, in many ways just a parasite on their partners. So women may well be the last thing to be civilized by men, and thank heavens. And my teacher would say, you know, these women, the Melissae, will never be civilized. And he went on to say that those who have fallen into their arms rarely do so without falling into their hands, as I was eventually to learn to my cost. But and that was enough to send a sort of shiver down my spine and want to meet them desperately. But, you know, despite all of that, despite the drama of all of that, what I sensed was really being said was not, was actually that the role of the bee master and the bee mistress and the connection between them, it wasn't based on who was the superior of the two. Both roles were distinct and of equal importance. And their functions, when taken together, performed a kind of corporate responsibility. So the Melissae, I mean, getting back to my colleagues, the female members of the Path of Pollen, they are considered to be the physical representation of an ancient sisterhood, which is known as the sisterhood of the hive. This is a universal term. And they are transmitters of an archaic impulse, which is central to the Path of Pollen. And the Melissa, as a goddess, was a goddess of intoxication and sexual passion. And as I said, these are used as a doorway to a communion with all of life. And this is the impulse that the Melissae in the modern world continue to transmit. Now, when I first met the Melissae, I was just standing in the apiary, which is where the beehives were contained, and I was simply studying a single bee as it moved onto a flower. And this was one of the many instructions that my teacher gave me to hone my practice of observing and of entering the world of the bee so that I could understand their rituals and their energy. And I was so focused on this task that I hadn't noticed that one of these mysterious women had actually entered the orchard. And she very quietly made her way over to me. And then she whispered very lightly to me, "Is the flower the food of the bee, or is the bee the genitals of the flower?" It's an interesting question. And that was my informal introduction to them, which says something about what they're carrying and teaching. And I think I would like to say just a little bit more about this. The in terms of actually the type of women who tend to be drawn to this work, because they're considered to be one of two primary types. But what they have in common is that they are all fully empowered. Now, they're not empowered in the way that many women are in this day and age, which is kind of an attempt to regain power that was taken from them, which generally leads to women imitating men. I mean, if we look at nature, you know, the sun and the moon don't compete. They're opposites. And the Melissae are said to fall into two distinct groupings, two primary types that are drawn to the work. And there is the maternal type and the magnetic type. And the Melissae incline to varying degrees to one or other of these extremes. So if she's of the maternal type, she'll ask very little save to fecundate her and to protect for her offspring. Now, that offspring might be a ritual, it might be a project, it might be a child. But if she's of the magnetic type and true to the law of her nature, she will deny herself no one who calls to her in the name of the tradition. Does that make sense?
It does, but it's a little vague in denying someone. What do you mean by that?
I can give this to you as a metaphor, because that may be more vague, or it may actually open it up. The Path of Pollen, the teachings are driven by a physicality, but they are often delivered in metaphor. If we speak about these things in metaphor, we might say that there's one type of bee who moves from flower to flower, who sips nectar from one blossom to the next, picking up pollen from this bloom, and then she deposits it from one, she circulates pollen, and she fertilizes all the flowers. And as a result, the garden flourishes. And then back in the hive, she deposits the pollen-rich nectar into the communal vats, and which in the fullness of time will ripen into rich, dark, sweet honey. And this is considered to be a visible offering to the visible face of spirit. But then there's another type of bee who also moves from flower to flower, but doesn't sip nectar. Rather, she devours the blossom with all of her senses. So she inhales the fragrance and savors the taste and absorbs the color and so on. And she imbibes the joy of the song evoked by the sunlight on the petals and so on. And then back in the hive, she also shares the bounty with the community. And we might see the image of them gathering together, each bee dancing an expression of the blessings that she's gathered, dancing the joy and the splendor and so on. And one by one, all the bees will add their share to fill the cauldron in the center. And then they all dance together, encircling the cauldron and singing the praises of the visible face of spirit. And the resulting blend of this will also ripen and ferment into honey and is also rich and sweet, but to most people is utterly invisible. Now, that's the metaphor that was given to me. If I want to then flip back onto talking in more concrete terms, I would talk about the Melissae as being a metaphor for the hive itself. The Melissae uses her body as a means of producing particular nectars. And these nectars are liquids that are keys, that are strings on a celestial harp, that are gifts that induce certain states, including the gift of extended life. These nectars are produced by what we might call an endocrine alchemy. It's a that's really the best way I have of describing it, an endocrine alchemy. It's a kind of a what might otherwise be called a form of Western Tantra. Within the path of pollen, as well as having mapped out the meridians, they also mapped out what commonly in the Western world are called chakras. Now, within the path of pollen, the chakra is known as an interior star, otherwise known as the other term that we use is a wheel. Stimulating the interior stars, it releases liquids from particular endocrine glands into the body of the Melissae, and those elixirs are then released from the Melissae. So these are the nectars that the Melissae bring as a gift for the tradition itself.
What words of wisdom? I mean, obviously, all of this is one beautiful poetic metaphor for all of our lives and relates equally well. The poetics of it certainly equal the honey and sweetness and nourishment. But in a couple of sentences, what do you want to say to the beekeepers of the world who had no idea what was going on with this? Or maybe I'm totally naive, and of course they have an inkling.
Well, you know, my teacher used to talk about beekeepers as being linked strangers. And, of course, most beekeepers will have no connection with this tradition, and they have no need to have a connection with this tradition. They are the innocent beneficiaries of a way of life that brings about harmony and balance. I think probably rather than wanting to speak to the beekeepers who are listening, I'd be more inclined to speak to those people who are not beekeepers. Because if anything, I would adore it if my book inspired people to consider the possibility of stepping into the beautiful craft of the bee. In other words, to step into a relationship with our most ancient ally. The bottom line, Robin, is that the number of beekeepers in the world has diminished considerably.
Yes, very good point.
In Britain, just after the Second World War, there were something around 80,000 to 90,000 beekeepers, and now it's 30,000 to 40,000. Now, if we want to keep the world a fertile place, we need to have our bees. So for the future of our world, to keep it a fertile place for our children and our children's children, for the next seven generations and beyond, we need to step into the craft. So my invitation is to encourage people not just to imbibe the gifts of the hive, but also to consider having communion with humanity's most ancient ally, the sacred honeybee.
The Shamanic Way of the Bee with Simon Buxton. For anything tributaries related, it's tributariesradio.wordpress.com. We're podcasting all over and YouTube is kicking in, so join us there if you like. I'm Robin Clare. Thanks for staying tuned.